Israel and its key supporter, the U.S., have strongly opposed this. The White House has stressed it will go on to uphold full commitment to Tel Aviv. Now, will the ICC be able to put an end to the impunity and bring the Israeli criminals to justice? We'll discuss those questions and some other issues after going to Ramallah to our correspondent, Mona Kandil there. Mona, tell us, how do Palestinians feel about this?
Well, the Palestinians praised the move, and the Palestinian Authority urged world states to refrain from politicizing these independent proceedings, especially that the ICC announcement has angered both the United States and Israel, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying clearly that Israel is under attack today, and that the biased ICC in The Hague made a decision that is the essence of anti-Semitism and hypocrisy. So Palestinians today are very happy for this decision by the ICC, but at the same time, they are questioning that would the United States be allowing, of course it has furiously condemned the court, would it be allowing the prosecution of Israeli officials and forces, especially that it immediately condemned the ICC. More of the Palestinians, of course, have demanded the International Criminal Court to look into crimes during the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip in 2014, as well as the ongoing Israeli settlement activity and expansion in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Palestinians also expressed their readiness to cooperate with the ICC with preparing numerous files that would be giving, let's say, would be helping the ICC to prosecute Israeli officials and military officials in the Israeli regime.
Okay, definitely. They have the footage of those protests and even targeting media people along with women and kids. Thank you for that. That was Mona Kandil telling us about how the Palestinians feel about this. Now, joining me in this debate show will be MEP with the Ireland South, Nick Wallace, is in Brussels. And we'll also have former UN rapporteur in the occupied territories, Richard Falk, who is joining us out of Yalıkavak, I believe. It must be in Turkey. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let's go to Mick Wallace, Chief Prosecutor. The Suda is speaking of having conducted a painstaking preliminary examination that lasted almost 5 years. And she's promised an independent, impartial, and objective investigation without fear or favor. Would that be possible?
It would be very difficult, without fear or favor. I mean, she's already highlighted the fact that they're under-resourced, and listen, they find it difficult to operate, right? If you look at the history of the ICC, you will see that they struggle to get good results a lot of the time. And, you know, you have the very fact that the likes of the Americans and the Israelis don't even recognize it, I mean, is a problem, because obviously the U.S. and Israel think they're above international law. But it's a good move that this has happened. It's good that the ICC have gone to this space and addressed the issue. But I wouldn't be jumping up and down about the prospects of getting a great result. Now listen, it's not rocket science that the Israeli military forces in the West Bank and Gaza commit terrible war crimes on a daily basis. But for the ICC to come up with that, they're obliged to initially allow both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, to actually do their own investigations, and because that's part of the format. So what we're going to have now first is the Israeli government will actually be allowed to investigate allegations of criminal activity on the part of their military, and that'll be a whitewash for sure, 100%. Right, that's guaranteed to be a whitewash. Now, how the ICC deal with that then remains to be seen, and it'll be very challenging for them. I'm not saying that we're not going to get a decent result out of it. But I'm just saying it's hard to be optimistic that we're going to get the full truth. There'll be serious opposition to this.
Okay.
Israel, U.S., don't want the truth told about what the Israel does to the Palestinians
okay.
on a daily basis.
I'll come to those questions later on in the show. Now, let me turn to Richard. Benjamin Netanyahu has called the probe an anti-Semitic attack. You know, whatever you talk about Israel, they call it anti-Semitic. Is this really anti-Semitic attack?
That's really an absurd and outrageous response to a judicial process that has leaned over backwards to be careful and judicial in the best sense. And it, I think, expresses more than anything else the hopelessness of the Israeli position if one considers the substance of these allegations about minority in the occupied Palestinian territory. It is such a clear-cut set of facts backed by evidence, and the only recourse that Israel has is to denounce the institution and to act as if it's not accountable for any kind of violation of international law. And that's really very bad for, it's a bad precedent, it's irresponsible, but it's understandable because Israel has all along defied international international law, and it's had the geopolitical backing of the United States. Having said that, it's still a momentous decision if nothing else happens, because it legitimizes on the level of symbolic politics, which are very important in these struggles, the claims and the grievances that the Palestinian people have felt, and the very outrage that Netanyahu expresses is actually a confirmation of the weight of these grievances. And so the ICC has already done itself incredible positive credit by launching this investigation, even if no behavioral results in terms of indictments and convictions and punishments result from it.
Right. Now, Mick, ICC insists that it has reason to believe that Israeli authorities have committed war crimes. You know, it took them 5 years to do this preliminary probe, and on that basis they are making this a statement. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Richard's point is a very strong one. Whatever comes out of this now, it's been something really positive that they've gone to this space at all. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for them. And I think it puts pressure on the EU in particular. Unfortunately, right, Israel does what it likes and totally disrespects international law on a regular basis because it can. And the reason it can, obviously, is because the US would allow them to do anything they want. And unfortunately as well, people need to take on board that the EU bears responsibility too. And I would argue that the complicity of the EU and the silence of the EU in the face of terrible atrocities being committed against the people of Palestine, the Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, the people displaced outside the country in refugee camps and wherever, the treatment of those Palestinians is abysmal, and the EU bears responsibility for not standing up for the human rights of the Palestinians. They talk about human rights in areas where it's geopolitically suitable, but they ignore them a lot of the time where it doesn't suit the U.S. Because they have behaved for too long like a puppet of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this decision by the ICC to go to this space is going to put extra pressure on the EU to actually face up to the truth and become more involved in addressing the plight of the Palestinian people.
Okay. Now, Richard, speaking of the U.S., you know that Washington has expressed disappointment with and also opposition to this ICC move. And what does it mean? I mean, a crime is a crime, no matter who commits it, right?
It should be, but the geopolitical reality is that it's a crime if it's a weak state. If it's a strong state, there's no accountability unless it happens to lose a big war, as Germany and Japan did after World War II, and then there's some procedures of accountability for the losers. But the real message is there are double standards with respect to international criminal law. The weak can be held accountable. The strong and their friends are given impunity. And that's a sad and glaring weakness in the kind of world order that exists in the world today. And it's been so blatantly exposed in the way in which Israel has treated the Palestinian people now for decades. And the world watches, and I agree with what Mick said about the EU having complicity. There is no responsible reason for not backing the ICC in exercising its authority as it's vested in an international treaty. Mm-hmm. And if you read the documents that it has issued and the long preliminary investigation that it conducted, it's beyond reasonable doubt that there were crimes committed, that it is appropriate to hold Israel and Hamas. We haven't mentioned the fact that the ICC also is investigating crimes that are alleged to have been committed by Hamas in the form of using indiscriminate rockets in the 2014 skirmish with Israel. So that the undertaking is really the most dramatic and significant in the history of the International Criminal Court, and will bring, I think, great credit to it if it's able to persist at least to the extent that it won't give way to the kind of pressures that Israel, the United States, and maybe some other countries will exert.
Okay. Now, Mick, both of you referred to the EU as an accomplice to the U.S. in blind support for Israeli crimes. You're a member of the European Parliament. Tell our viewers what you or maybe your colleagues have done or planning to do regarding exposing the Israeli crimes within the European Parliament.
Well, for those of you that follow, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm also on Security and Defense. And a lot of the plenary sessions that are held once a month for a week cover foreign affairs matters. In fact, a huge chunk of the plenary is devoted to foreign affairs. I would ask the people themselves to judge as to whether we're having an impact, but we're not afraid to speak out. We are not beholden to anybody. We fight for justice anywhere in the world, and we see it as our responsibility at all times, and without fear or favour. We're not pandering to an electorate, wondering, are we going to get elected the next time if we don't do this or we don't do that, or if we say this or we say that. We were in the Irish Parliament for 8.5 years, myself and Claire Daly, And we didn't pander to the electorate, but we still kept getting elected, and we got elected to the European Parliament. And obviously, in the European Parliament, no one would be surprised to hear that at least 90% of the European Parliament, of the 705 MEPs, I would say 90% of them are of an Atlanticist nature, which is unfortunate. But I would also argue that while 90% of the members of the European Parliament we find ourselves in opposition to on a daily basis, I would argue that they don't fairly represent the citizens of Europe. There's 450 million people in Europe, and I would say the majority of them are completely in favour of the Palestinians being treated in a fair manner and then being put to what is a form of genocide against the Palestinian people by Israel for a long time now. That is not what the European people want. It might be what a lot of the politicians in the European Parliament sign up to, because they are in the pockets of lobbyists who have a vested interest in pushing them in a particular direction.
Okay. Now, Richard, how would Washington's all-out support for the Tel Aviv regime affect the tribunal's probe?
Well, of course, it's hard to tell. It has no legitimate basis for exerting influence whatsoever. The tribunal is supposed to operate as an independent international institution. The U.S. is not a party to the treaty constituting this international criminal court, and it really is obliged to act responsibly by allowing it to function in accordance with its own constitutional framework. And if it doesn't allow, there will be a civil society effect of this decision, which we shouldn't overlook. It will help things like the BDS campaign that has been trying to exert nonviolent pressure on the Israeli government to uphold international law and to acknowledge and address the grievances of the Palestinian people. And this decision, even if it doesn't result in any behavioral outcomes, will be a tremendous support, will lend tremendous support to the global solidarity movement that may in the end be the most significant outcome of what has happened so far.
Okay. And Mick, the ICC is also intending to probe Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, the illegal settlement activity, and also the deliberate response to anti-occupation rallies that happened in 2018. How serious and what type of verdict would you issue for those crimes and illegal land grab?
Listen, that's kind of too easy a question in some ways. A big concern for me today is that international law is not being fully respected by the international community. And it's a sad time when we have the likes of the European Union introducing sanctions against countries like Iran, like Syria, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, you name it, introducing sanctions that are actually illegal. Sanctions are only illegal if they are backed up by a UN resolution. Most of the sanctions that have been applied today, and the Americans have sanctions against 38 countries, and very sadly, Europe supports a lot of them. But the demise of international law is really worrying. I'm not saying that it's going to continue, because I actually don't believe that the European Union can continue on this path of being a complete puppet to US imperialism. Okay. And I would like to think that we will get back to a point where the EU really does respect international law and holds the likes of the Israelis to account for atrocities that they commit against anybody.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We had the MEP of Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and former UN rapporteur in the occupied territories, Richard Falk, who joined us out of Jelikavik. And that's it for this edition of The Debate.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to our show Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio I am Brother Yasser Ibrahim with you to introduce another book that hopefully will be beneficial to myself and to all our dear listeners one of the main concepts of Islam is spiritual growth It is the ability to attain perfection by effort. We do not believe that a person can just sit down and perfection will come to him. No. It is that attainment of perfection by perfecting one's own behavior with others, with perfecting one's ethics. And it is in this way that a person develops his spiritual growth. And this is why the title of the book that we will be introducing to our dear listeners today is a very important book, especially in the contemporary era. That in a time where we are surrounded by everything that destroys our soul, there must be a means by which we are able to kind of fight back and how to protect our soul, how to know, how do I kind of pass by this danger zone without falling into its traps. So this book, known as Ethics and Spiritual Growth, is a book that does that. It is a book that looks at the certain events that occurred, the certain circumstances that individuals right now are in, and provides them with a particular roadmap, a particular model for how to shape their lives in a way to, as I mentioned, fight back and to protect themselves. And not only to protect themselves, to progress and to advance in a spiritual manner. In a world that only focuses upon the material, this book is one of those books that is essential for all of us to read, to ponder upon, and to not only do that, but to put into practice, which is the most important part. It is no point just reading certain concepts and not putting them into practice. That just makes it, worthless. Yes, if you read certain practical concepts, the point of it taking effect is when we see it in the outside world and in our own actions and behaviors. Inshallah, in further introducing the contents of this book in our next segment, please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our show, Bookshelf on IRIB, English Radio. In our previous segment, we were speaking about the concept of ethics, a concept that Islam extremely emphasizes on. We have traditions where the Holy Prophet said that he has only been sent to perfect human ethics. This book, with the title Ethics and Spiritual Growth, written by the late Sayyid, the late great scholar, Sayyid Mujtaba Musawilari, rahmatullah alayh, which was translated then by Sayyid Ali Kuli Qurai, who is the translator of the Holy Quran as well. and was published by many different publications, but the one here is Ansarian publication. It has also been published by other publications. So in the introduction to this book, the Sayyid mentions the reason why this book was written. It is hoped that the contents of this book, which draws its material from the rich Islamic sources and represents the ethos of religious teachings, and in addition, presents the views and opinions of Western scholars concerning the problems relating to education and psychology. Now, this is where I want to focus on, is that what we mean by education here, or what has been translated as education, should actually be self-development. And psychology in most of the Islamic books, which is the translated form for ilmun nafs, is not psychology that we know as medical psychology, no. It is the science of the soul, what is known as spiritual psychology, will serve as a beneficial moral and social guide. It is hoped that it will make a contribution, however humble, to highlighting the true goals of self-development, or, as the translator put it, education. This book was first translated and published in the Tawhid Journal, and then published as a separate book. It is quite an extensive book. It contains about 430 pages. It contains a preface and 14 chapters. The first chapter beginning with man's movement towards perfection, that man has to, find a way to get towards that perfection. He must not stay. And then it goes through certain other principles and fundamentals that which a person needs in order to enact that self-development. And it ends with the chapter on fear, but not fear in its positive sense, no. Here, fear in its negative sense. And it is from this chapter in our next segment where we will read a segment from this particular book for our dear listeners. Inshallah, see you then.
7 barometric pressure.
I come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Stay tuned to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We have reached the third segment of our episode where we are discussing the book Ethics and Spiritual Growth by the late Sayyid, the late great scholar, Ayatollah Mujtaba Musawilari. Alhamdulillah, I had the great opportunity of meeting and having a personal kind of interaction with him. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala raise his status, inshallah. So this book, as we mentioned, contains 14 chapters, the last chapter dealing with fear. In this chapter, there is a segment that is known and something that I found may be beneficial to all of us, because we all may suffer from this, which is known as the weakness of will, that we do not motivate ourselves enough. So the book reads, "A weak will is the product of irrational fears. Doubt and vacillation may be the first signs of a deep-seated fear. Wherever there is doubt and hesitation, faith is absent. For one who lacks a perfect faith is constantly troubled by doubt and uncertainty. Hesitation and indecisiveness become his habitual traits. A person possessing faith does not fall victim to doubt and hesitation in his activities and goals, and there is no room in his mind and consciousness for vexing anxieties. A human being whose spirit is full of faith and sincere intentions, and who has established an unbreakable bond with God's infinite power, is more powerful than any degenerate power in the whole world. Even if he should suffer a setback and defeat in his confrontation with the material power of evil, he will not consider himself insecure and abandoned, for with all his being he relies on the great power of God and is led by his guidance, which is true guidance. Overcoming corruption and guiding the lost ones to the right path are fundamental elements deeply rooted in the Islamic faith, traits which become the part of the spiritual makeup of the persons. By relying upon the everlasting power of God, they can subjugate to their will material powers which are not the sole reality of the world." So as we can see from this segment, that it is important for a person to understand where he is attaching himself. Is he attaching himself to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or to this material world. Insha'Allah, we hope that this program was beneficial, and we hope that insha'Allah our knowledge and our understanding of Islam increases. Insha'Allah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Following warnings that the coronavirus triggered drop in planet warming emissions would be short-lived without structural changes, the International Energy Agency released data showing that global CO2 emissions from the energy sector were 2% higher in December 2020 compared to the same month the previous year. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New IEA Data Shows World on Path to Resume Carbon-Intensive Business as Usual. Stay tuned for the details, please. Warnings that the coronavirus-triggered drop in planet warming emissions would be short-lived without structural changes, the International Energy Agency released data recently showing that global CO2 emissions from the energy sector were 2% higher in December 2020 compared to the same month the previous year. The Paris-based agency said the figures reflect a lack of concrete action by global governments to follow through on pledges to meet net zero emissions by 2050, and predicted 2021 emissions would continue the upward trend, barring sufficiently bold action. The rebound in global carbon emissions toward the end of last year is a stark warning that not enough is being done to accelerate clean energy transitions worldwide. If governments don't move quickly with the right energy policies, this would put at risk the world's historic opportunity to make 2019 the definitive peak in global emissions, said IEA Executive Director Faith Birrell. The IEA Executive Director Birol further warned that the figures show we are returning to carbon-intensive business as usual. This year is pivotal for international climate action, he added. But these latest numbers are a sharp reminder of the immense challenge we face in rapidly transforming the global energy system. While emissions in the U.S. dropped 10% in 2020 overall, the downward trend began moving back up after a low point in spring. The nation capped off 2020 with December emissions being nearly the same as those in December 2019. In India, an increase in emissions began in September with the loosening of COVID-19-related restrictions. The global shutdowns brought about by the pandemic resulted in a historic drop in global emissions, which climate activists said should be no substitute for real climate action, and scientists said would ultimately do little to rein in global temperature increase. Stressing that there is no time to lose to address atmospheric concentrations of CO2, WMO Secretary General Petteri Tala said in November, "We breached the global threshold of 400 parts per million in 2015, and just 4 years later we crossed 410 ppm. Such a rate of increase has never been seen in the history of our records. The lockdown-related fall in emissions is just a tiny blip on the long-term graph," said Thomas. "We need a sustained flattening of the curve." Among those responding to the new IEA figures was Greta Thunberg of the Youth-led Climate Movement for the Future. "Well," Thunberg tweeted, "looks like the so-called ambitious commitments to include green policies in the economic recovery packages aren't really working out." Greenpeace weighed in on new findings as well, tweeting, "Real climate action and systematic changes are urgently needed. Governments and corporations are returning to carbon-intensive business as usual, while extreme weather events wreak havoc and displace millions of people across the globe," said the climate group. Global emissions from electricity sector dropped by 450 million tons in 2020. This resulted partly from lower electricity demand, but also from increases in electricity generation by solar PV and wind. For the world to achieve the climate goals of the Paris Agreement, notably of limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, a decline in electricity sector emissions of around 500 million tons would need to occur every single year. Even greater annual drops in emissions from the electricity generation would be required to put the world on a path in line with warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. In order to show a sustainable path forward, the IEA will publish on May 18th the world's first comprehensive roadmap for the energy sector to reach net zero emissions by 2050. As part of its focus on leading clean energy transitions worldwide, the IEA is working with the UK COP26 presidency to bring together heads of governments and ministers at IEA COP26 Net Zero Summit on March 31st to step up international efforts to turn net zero pledges into concrete energy policies and actions.
Around the world with reporters.
jubilations among ranks and files of the opposition parties after the Senate elections in Pakistan. The combined opposition parties have managed to retain its majority in 100-member Senate. The Senate elections were held against 37 seats, and the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan won 25 seats. Khan's party emerged as the single largest political force in the Senate for the first time. Nonetheless, Khan's party, together with its allies, is still short of 6 senators to gain majority in the Senate. Under the proportionate election systems, 4 provincial parliaments, together with the national parliament, elect 100-member Senate. After every 3 years, half of the senators retire, and regional and federal parliaments elect remaining members of the upper house of the parliament through secret balloting. Despite emerging as the single largest political force in the Senate elections, Khan's party suffered a major setback when the 342-member lower house of the parliament elected opposition candidate Yousuf Raza Gilani as the senator. Gilani is also the former prime minister of Pakistan. With the election of Gilani, the opposition is now eyeing at dislodging the prime minister. The opposition says Khan has lost majority in the National Assembly, which had elected him prime minister in 2018.
Imran Khan ko istifa dena chahiye.
Now Prime Minister Imran Khan must resign. It is not only a demand by the opposition, but Senate pattern indicates that it is also demand of members of the ruling party.
Aapka 11.
Opposition candidate won the elections amid a video scandal on mainstream media showing agent of opposition offering tens of millions of dollars to win over MPs of the ruling party.
Opposition must feel ashamed of what they are talking about. The video shows selling votes to the opposition, which back up our stance against corruption.
Under pressure from the opposition parties, the government has announced that Prime Minister Imran Khan would soon take a fresh vote of confidence from the National Assembly. Analysts say that Khan is likely to retain his majority in the lower house of the parliament. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to bring former President Abdul Rabbu Mansur Hadi, who had resigned and fled the country, back to power. But with nearly 6 years into the war, Saudi Arabia has achieved none of its goals, and the war has left no choice for Yemenis but to resist. In the latest development, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia's Jeddah on Thursday. The army also said it had successfully hit the King Khalid Airbase in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The attacks come in reaction to Saudi Arabia's ongoing war, despite Washington's pledge to end it. U.S. President Joe Biden ordered to halt arms sales to the kingdom to stop them being used in Yemen. However, Biden pledged to continue supporting Riyadh to defend its sovereignty. Analysts say the U.S. continues to transfer arms to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of selling defensive weapons.
When Joe Biden stated that he was not going to sell offensive missiles and weaponry to Saudi Arabia, that is what we call gobbledygook, because a weapon can be both defensive and offensive.
Besides, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Yemen says the humanitarian situation resulted from the Saudi blockade has even become worse after Biden took office.
Actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration.
The UN had appealed for $3.85 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs in Yemen, but only $1.7 billion was offered at this year's donor conference. The UN described the pledges as disappointing and stressed that cutting aid would mean a death sentence for Yemeni people. Yemen relies on imports that have been badly disrupted over the years by the Saudi-led war and blockade. According to the World Body, the war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. A recent report showed some 16 million Yemenis, or more than half the population, is going hungry. Of those, 5 million are on the brink of famine. The UN stressed that the only solution to end the crisis in Yemen is ceasefire and a political solution. But considering the current stance by the West toward Yemen, it seems the US and its allies do not want the war to stop anytime soon.
In a press conference held in Yemeni capital of Sana'a, the country's Ministry of Water and Environment elaborated on the damage inflicted to the water resources and infrastructure due to the Saudi-led invasion since 2015. The ministry said the war has impacted the sector severely, depriving thousands of Yemenis of access to drinking water. Officials said the war and siege imposed on the country have heavily affected the water supplies and forced millions to use unhealthy ways to store water. However, they say the severe fuel crisis has a major role in water shortage.
The per capita daily share of water consumption has dropped to 35 liters, and the lack of fuel will cause further decline and make matters worse. Water treatment and sanitation are also directly linked to fuel, so lack of fuel and the interruption in these processes may cause epidemics and endanger millions of lives.
Water resources and infrastructure are among the vital sectors that have been targeted by the Saudi-imposed war on Yemen. The war has left millions of Yemeni people without access to food and water, causing what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of Yemenis, including women and children, died of cholera during the 6 years of war. However, the Yemeni struggle to reach clean drinking water continues. The coronavirus pandemic has also worsened the situation in a country where more than 80% of people are in need of humanitarian assistance and support. The Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gadzaev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
And this is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just they block it either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli-issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
less than 10% of the EU's inhabitants have so far been given a COVID-19 vaccine. This is minuscule when compared to the progress made in the bloc's closest allies, the UK and US. Vaccine producers have been grilled in the European Parliament. AstraZeneca is accused of not fulfilling contracts it signed with the EU.
How is it possible that you had no clue of your production capacity? Because what has happened is not a minor setback, it's a huge failure.
AstraZeneca is providing 60% fewer doses to the EU in the first quarter of the year than promised.
How does AstraZeneca explain the export of vaccine produced in the EU to the UK, but at the same time the company is not willing to ship vaccine from the production site in the UK to the EU?
The firm is promising to ramp up production. It says delays happen because hundreds of ingredients are required to make the vaccine.
What is made in the EU, as I said before, overwhelmingly stays in the EU, including the site in the Netherlands that was originally reserved by the UK.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was developed by Germany, but the EU signed supply contracts 4 months after the UK. EU countries such as Hungary, Austria and Denmark are availing of vaccines from China, Russia and Israel. This shows divisions are growing within the bloc as nations break away from the European Commission's vaccination strategy. EU citizens are growing more impatient by the day as they witness the health and economic impacts of the pandemic.
If EU would be able to press more intensively on the producers or pharmaceutical companies producing the vaccines, that would be wonderful.
Of course, this is the solution. It must be quicker because, you know, within 2 months, the summer will begin.
The European Medicines Agency, or EMA, is the EU institution that approves vaccines in the bloc. Producers were asked to comment on the EMA's seemingly slow approval record.
All of the data that goes to support the application for approval in the UK is actually being shared with the EMA.
One angry lawmaker suggested the only thing not delayed are the profits being raked in by pharmaceutical giants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic elite relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship, and I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink, and with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France, and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. Homolezgi v Vienna.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today, we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made Chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young Chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
And the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
Yeah, a lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment, is literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks, help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puriza, London.
Prisoners' rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners and demanded an end to Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. Some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers.
Israel has demonstrated zero accountability and acts with impunity because it enjoys the full support of the United States. Israel considers itself as an entity that is above international law. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the Palestinian people, especially against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as around 400 of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Palestinian prisoners are suffering because of medical negligence as well as administrative detention.